I'm Christopher Ludden with the historian of ideas at Princeton University, Daniel Rogers. For people like me who are groping to account for this strange, nervous condition in a country we thought we knew, Daniel Rogers had written an explanation that's both surprising and somehow satisfying about this age of fracture. The book is about words we live by, ideas that have come to govern us, basic words like freedom, responsibility, danger, obligation, opportunity, many of them with new meanings today. Above all, there is this riddle of those three magic words, we the people and who we are. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This is one more crack at the how fares the land question that the historian Tony Judt left us with as he died 2 years ago of Lou Gehrig's disease. Dan Rogers, what is it that's broken?
Well, what is it that's broken? One thing that's not broken, Chris, one thing that we sometimes imagine to be broken is that society itself is more fractured, more multicultural, more divided than ever before. That's actually not true. This has been a multicultural, argumentative, debating nation with a big civil war in the middle of its history. That's not what's changed, I think, or at least what I tried to write about in Age of Fracture. But what changed is a whole set of words, a language, and a set of articulated assumptions about who we were that was so strong in the middle of the 20th century, and in fact builds all the way from the early part of the 20th century. That is to say, there was a collective social we. There were bonds of interdependence between folks, between persons in neighborhoods and in the nation and in the world. And we have let that disaggregate, fracture, splinter off into pictures of isolated individuals, as if that were what were really real. And that's what I mean by fracture.
What's your answer on the how fares the land question? Quick diagnosis.
Well, many things one wants to be terribly optimistic about in America now. The sense of innovation, the sense of a forward movement in lots of fronts, the new toleration of that's growing in this country. But, and this is where I would agree with Tony Judt, there's a loss as well. And the loss is an ability to speak clearly and articulately about what we depend upon from each other.
May I say, for my generation, not far from yours, the shock is waking up to debt beyond measure, for starters, a dread of decline, tremendous division and rancorous division, raging inequality, disrepute of great institutions, starting with the Congress, including the Catholic Church, among other things, and then American disrepute in the world. And the real point is that nobody seems to have a plan to correct anything anytime soon. This is not the country I grew up in. How about you?
Well, your last point is the one I would want to underscore, Chris, because it is not the country that any of us grew up in of a certain age. But we have morphed so slowly and, as it were, without thinking toward another country that sometimes it's hard to see where the turning points are, what the breaking points were, what the change is. It's not the same country, I think, above all, because though there is optimism out in the country, there's a great sense of forward movement in parts of the country. It's tied to very, very narrow understandings of, as we said, the we, the national purpose, the possibilities of social life. It's tied to a libertarian resentment against government, as if government were somehow extra human beyond the things that we do together. And this happened on both the right and the left. And so one of the reasons why it's hard for people to imagine ways forward, one of the reasons why it's hard for people to think about the future in any other terms except making it, catching the winds of history, becoming whatever one hopes for oneself, is that we haven't found a social science, we haven't found a political science, we haven't found a set of social theories with traction that were just common sense when you and I were young.
You're writing about 30 or 35 years of a war of words, words being tokens of ideas and slogans around economics, maybe especially, but also about power, about identities, personal in the matter of gender, race, class, that sort of thing, but also national identity. To me, the stunning thing, having lived through those culture wars, as you did, is that they didn't prepare us at all for the condition, the real condition we're in. It's almost as if the theory wars were a decoy to take our eye off the reality, which is the concentration of wealth, first and foremost.
Concentration of wealth is really important. Concentration of wealth is not new in American history. It has actually been worse than it before in earlier periods than it is now. But it was regretted before. There was a sense that there was something wrong with a country that managed to create such vast amounts of wealth amidst so much poverty. Read any of the books about the great cities, New York City, Chicago, San Francisco, Atlanta, whatever, in the 20th century, and you find a literature called Sunshine and Shadows. Go walk in Fifth Avenue and then go down to Hell's Kitchen. Go up to Nob Hill and then go down to the wharfs. And to think about the city was to be embarrassed by those contrasts. The contrasts are there without embarrassment, and that's one of the shifts of our time.
Above all, we're talking about an age of economics and famous economists, but who among them, the big ones, warned us that the risk in all the calculation of private choices and micro, macro, and rational consumers and all this stuff, who told us that the risk was a busted economy? Busted economy, jobs gone to China, young workers now coming out of school in miserable debt, broken markets, and a plutocracy. Who had their eye on that big picture?
Well, no one. There is no one who had their eye on that picture. One of the striking things about economics as a discipline, I suppose, is it's always catching up to things that it didn't anticipate. The Great Depression of the 30s was unanticipated. It's only in the middle of it that Keynes begins to try to figure out how it happened. And then those Keynesian models didn't work terribly well in the way that people tried to apply them in the next great moment of economic collapse. And they're not working terribly well now. Neither is the opposite, and so the economists are really groping at this moment into a world they didn't anticipate and didn't help us to understand. But one of the most important shifts in economics, and this is one of the themes that runs through Age of Fracture, is that at the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, into the 70s, economists thought big. They thought about the macroeconomic character of the whole. They thought about issues of development, how poor nations could become richer nations. They thought in terms of large and aggregate pictures. And then came a mental revolution when they began to think that the way to figure out the most interesting things in economics was to imagine choosing individuals, imagine these atomistic characters who had things they wanted, desires. They went after them rationally. They were all stockbrokers in a way. The world was made up of stockbrokers. And once you understood that, you had a hold on the economy. But it didn't turn out to work.
No, that's understating it. One of the threads we've got to pursue, and we'll get to it, but is my feeling reading your book that there's been a sort of treason of the intellectuals, or the universities just kind of checked out. The most famous example might be the famous three economists on the cover of Time magazine, Robert Rubin, Larry Summers, and Alan Greenspan. The headline was The Committee to Save the World. Later, they're called the Subprime Three. But there's a feeling of abandonment by the grown-ups who we thought were in charge.
I'm not sure abandonment is the right word. The way I prefer to think about things, or the way I do think about this period, is that in pursuit of certain kinds of parts of our social life together, the intellectuals went off looking for worlds of individual choice. They went off looking for ways to help people understand their diversity. They turned upon that 1950s social conformity. They turned upon that nationalism. They turned upon that isolated sense of sameness and tried to help us draw a picture of more complex, more different individual possibilities of being.
Who are you thinking of, for example?
So I'm thinking about early on, David Riesman's critique of the conformistic society. I'm thinking about the 1960s culture wars when women, African-Americans, hippies, ordinary folks, blue-collar folks, all said, I am me and I am different. There was something we want to applaud in all that. But the economists took that as if the world itself were only made up of individual billiard ball, atomistic people. Institutions, power, the structural ways in which small decisions that people make turn out to have very, very large consequences, possibilities of collective irrationality, overpricing of stocks, the possibility that, in fact, what we call rational choice wasn't, in the aggregate, always the right or the rational thing to do. That got left out of the picture.
You cover so much ground in the book, Dan Rogers. I was going to ask you to sort of improvise on a number of sort of pregnant lines, some of them famous statements over the last 30, 35 years, and take it where you will, but we'll touch some ground that way. Starting with your own observation that by the mid-1970s, that's Carter time, Ford, end of Nixon time, by the end of the mid-70s, the engines that had worked in the United States to diminish income inequality since 1945 had quietly slipped into reverse. That's before Reagan, before we saw anything like that happening. What was happening?
That's simply a fact that everybody knows. If you map the inequality in the United States, it begins to diminish in the 1940s, and inequality diminishes up until the mid-1970s, and then the shift begins to take place, and it now has grown really and accelerated in our own time. Nobody knows why, Chris. Nobody actually does understand precisely why this is true. There are many theories out there. But the striking thing was how difficult it was for people to understand that that was in fact the case. The first efforts to point to this shifting curve were in fact deeply criticized, being partisan, being ill-conceived as being from the political left. But now we know that they had their finger on something.
It wasn't about Chinese imports. Was it legislated? Did it have to do with taxes? What might have triggered it?
Their economists will know better than I. There are a number of things that did trigger it. It wasn't tax policy in the first place, though tax policy has changed in order to accommodate this and finally to encourage it, of course. The shifts in estate taxation policy probably has a lot to do with this. One of the reasons was the change in the labor force. And so when women moved into the labor force in a very, very large way, all kinds of new workers now being counted for the first time, in some ways, the labor force, the economy was forced to incorporate far more workers than before. This was an unexpected consequence of a really important moment in the history of women's equality. But it was like many of these phenomena. I think there was no single trigger. There was a series of accumulated events. And then, how do I say this? Then a sense that what had happened was just the way it was. It was natural. We should expect this. Of course, smart people make a lot of money. Of course, innovators should get whatever they deserve from this. Of course. And it's the of course that I'm trying to challenge in the book.
Another line. Love your reaction. Margaret Thatcher, 1987. She said, "There is no such thing as society. There are individual men and women, and there are families," end quote. That became a doctrine sort of in this country. It drove Tony Judt up the wall.
What's interesting about the Thatcher quote is that actually Margaret Thatcher talked about society a fair amount. She was enough of an old school Church of England type to know better than what she said. But it's not unimportant that this line gets pulled out, that this line becomes almost iconic of Thatcher and her position. And it goes back to a line by Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman wrote a very famous essay once on the social responsibility of corporations. This was out of 60s, early 70s, concerned that corporations had responsibilities toward their workers, toward the environment, toward the society in which they lived in, toward the consumers of the products that they made, toward society generally. And Milton Friedman said explicitly, and I'm sure Margaret Thatcher picked it straight up from him, she being one of his fervent admirers, that corporations have no responsibility whatsoever except to their shareholders. Profit. That's what corporations were in the business for.
But they were people even then, right?
Yes, there were people even then. But to go back for a second about there is no such thing as society, what Friedman argued was that society can't call out anything called responsibility. Only individual people can make claims. He was a devoted libertarian in the sense that he believed that communities were less real than individuals, that societies were less real than individuals, that families were less real than individuals, that the basic building block was people, and the rest was made up.
Well, there's the theme of your book right there, in a sense.
Yes, that is true. That is true. How we've lost that larger sense of connection and how that, those bigger words have fractured.
Different line entirely. From Cornel West on African-American identity. This was early 90s. He said, "I begin with a radical cultural hybridity, an improvisational new world sensibility. I'm not for a solid anything."
I know Cornell, and I'm very fond of him in many, many ways. And Cornell would also say that I pulled that that statement out. He's an extraordinarily interesting and important thinker. But what he put his finger on is that the sense of entrapment, in the categories that the sociologists and the others made for us, he did not want people to be pinning him down by the color of his skin, by one or another political statement, by his associations. And in particular, of course, he was fighting with the Afrocentrists at that moment, who argued that the skin was really it, that if you were black, that you inherited a cosmos, you inherited a being, you inherited a personhood. And Cornell, bless him, wanted to say no.
As feminists, too, also discovered that there were so many kinds of feminism that you couldn't call us just females or women or almost anything.
I mean, one of the themes of Age of Fracture is the ways in which these movements of collective identity and collective solidarity, feminism and the Black Power movement in particular, found themselves confronted with the actual diversity of persons who were collected under these banners. Women come in just as men do, just as all people do, in an enormous number of varieties. They began to fall apart upon certain fault lines. They began to argue with each other. What else might one have expected, except that in that certain utopian beginnings of these movements, there was a sense of a collective we.
Going back to Cornel West's line about hybridity, and he is a hybrid, and praise God for it, there are also people who would say a black person walking in the wrong neighborhood at 11 o'clock at night looks like a black person to a cop, and that's a fundamental reality too. The cop doesn't see a hybrid or a mystery or a social construct. He sees a black person. And suddenly, with this new book on the new Jim Crow, people are being reminded that there are huge solidarities when you look at statistics, when you look at incarceration, when you look at different kinds of drug use, for example. How do we get that back into Cornell's formula?
Well, you're talking about structures, social structures, and that's there are a lot of really important social scientists now. There are a lot of people in politics, too. There are a lot of people in public life, not in politics, but simply doing interesting work out in the world, who really do think in terms of structures, that it doesn't matter whether you have in your circle of friends a black person or not. What matters comes out in these statistics. It comes out in these larger graphs. It's these things that are in the structure of society, even if you cannot put a name to them. We need to believe in those because they tell us some really ugly. They also tell us some important and encouraging truths.
Another quote from another moment. Pat Buchanan at the Republican Convention, 1992. "The culture war is on," he said, "for the soul of America." And it encompassed schools, school prayer, immigration, secular humanism, the agenda to recover a religious language of patriotism, and other things. What about that manifesto?
Well, there is no doubt that one of the ways to understand, a crucial way of understanding the last quarter of the 20th century, is to take seriously the cultural battles, the real, more than skirmishes, the pieces of the culture war that erupted in the 1960s, all kinds of things that people had accepted as true, all kinds of tacit assumptions about selves, sexuality, natures, all these came into challenge. And when the Pat Buchanans recoiled in anger, they were not making it up. But one of the results has been a perpetuation of a kind of a sense of warfare in politics, that those folks who imagine themselves all alike will cluster in one corner of American society against the barbarians who seem to be so different from themselves. This we versus they. That helps to control politics now. It's deep in the structures of political argument, political advertising, political recruiting. That one thinks about Franklin Roosevelt in contrast, for example, Franklin Roosevelt, who was not kind to those he did not like. The malefactors of great wealth did not come off easily in Roosevelt's speeches, but much more of his rhetoric was about that encompassing people, the people of America, who in this position together, suddenly founding themselves, the ship went down, they're in the life rafts, they have to find ways of surviving together in this disaster. That's the rhetoric we see really quite rare in politics now.
Another telltale line, John Nesbitt's line in Megatrends, 1982. He said early on, the computer will crush the pyramid, meaning industrial hierarchies of all kinds, sort of anticipating the notion that the world is flat.
Right. The world isn't flat. We all know that. It's things move in this world at enormous speed, that some pyramids of power have been crushed, but others get created in their wake. That's the way it always is. And the problem is finding a way of understanding that, of taking it seriously, catching up to what's actually already happened.
It's still a spiky world, and especially, you know, in this rising inequality.
It is still a spiky world. It's always been a spiky world.
It's a zip code world. I mean, here we are in Princeton. This is as unlike Newark as it could be.
And unlike Trenton, only 10 miles away. But there are connections. The one thing I would say, because it's easy to fall into a pessimistic mode, and I don't mean Age of Fracture to be a pessimistic book. I mean it to be an analytical book. I mean it to be a book of description about who we are and how we've got to where we are and how we talked our way into the place we're in. But there are folks doing really interesting work, neighborhood work, street corner work in Trenton. There are folks trying to put a city back on its feet, and many of them have connections up to this exceedingly wealthy little town of Princeton. And that it's this background work that doesn't get articulated now.
Another telltale line. Historian Stuart Hall observes about Thatcherism and Reaganism that a new ideology has engulfed its victims. This is sort of an answer to the Tom Frank question about whatever happened to Kansas.
If by Thatcherism we mean looking out for oneself, if by Thatcherism we mean imagining that, well, back up a sec. The current flap about one of the Obama statements and one of the Elizabeth Warren statements about whether you make it on your own. It's extraordinary for an historian. Any historian who's looked at the 19th century, looked at the literature of the self-made man, looked at the literature of the, as it were, the person who makes himself out of himself and only himself. Everyone knows that that disappeared. Everyone knows it was challenged at the time. Even Horatio Alger's heroes didn't make it on their own. They always had help. They had help from patrons. They had help from people who guided them. They had help from people who bankrolled them for their early ventures. No one, I think, ever thought this statement would be challenged, that no one makes it totally on their own. And yet now, when either President Obama or Elizabeth Warren says this, the machinery, which is not only the machinery of politics, but it's a kind of machinery of social denial, gets into work.
Yeah, of course, they never qualify by saying nobody makes it completely on their own. The voice I'm missing in that whole conversation is Bill Gates's father. You know, he wrote a book on why we should have death taxes and inheritance taxes big time, because precisely his education, his son's education, rested on land-grant colleges, public institutions in Seattle, huge amounts of government research in all the fields where Bill became insanely rich. And his father says, get it back. It's sort of Buffett, too. But
well, there was a strong line among the super wealthy. And it still exists among many of the super wealthy. But it's not out there as publicly stated as it might be. Gates is a good example, but there are others, which is you have to pay back. You get from society, you pay back to society. This was what created the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation. It created most of the institutions of higher learning. It created the churches, the symphony orchestras. It created a huge amount of American social capital, but it was about payback.
And even the gospel line, to whom much is given, much is required.
Right.
Another telltale line. Frank Fukuyama's famous line and book title with the end of the Cold War, somewhere in the early 90s, he said we were witnessing not the passing of a particular period of history, but the end of history as such. How does that stand up? What does that mean today?
One of the interesting things about our current time, I think, is a loss of a sense of being able to think sequentially, think slowly, as one of my colleagues' recent book has put it, to think about things happening over relatively gradual but incremental sense of time. How does this happen? In part, it's about market ideas that move into our everyday language. We think about satisfaction as coming instantly. We think about people making choices and doing them very, very quickly. Fukuyama's notion that, in fact, Marx was no longer relevant, that Hegel was no longer relevant, that all the 19th century historians of the long march of history, of the inertia of the past, of the shaping power of institutions to control what's going to happen next, that all could now be assigned to the past, and we could do what we wanted. We lived in a world of freedom and of choice. The notion of turning Iraq around on a dime comes straight out of this. Our impatience with the current recession, as if it should have turned around on a dime because we wanted it so much to end. But we have lost a certain realism about history that was, again, strong in mid-20th century, much stronger than now.
We Americans are famous for not knowing our history, and of course we repeat it, but after Vietnam now and the Gulf and Afghanistan, I mean, it is becoming a sort of, not just repeating, but a kind of repetition compulsion syndrome without ever reflecting, for example, that our adventure with Iran, one example, began when we destroyed their democracy in 1953. They had a very promising post-colonial democracy. Kermit Roosevelt went in with hundreds of $100 bills and turned it around, sat the Shah on them. Nobody ever talks of that as the foundation of the Mullah's regime and the relations today, including their feeling about us. The jettisoning of history is kind of an astonishment to me, including our knowledge of the British history in Iraq and in Egypt, and again, the foundations of where we are.
Well, in a society where one values consumer choice, where one values the marketplace as we think about it, where one values the new, one values the up-to-date, and in fact, one devalues the old, right? We're not going to sell nearly as many iPads, computers, cars, clothes, whatever. We've known this as long as there's been a market society, and that's a very, very long time in human history by now. But as the markets saturate more and more of daily life, we become used to the devaluation of the old. Last year's T-shirt. Well, your history of the British Empire and the British imperial meddling in the Middle East is kind of like last year's T-shirt. Tell us what is new. And when this becomes the ways in which people make their mark as consultants, when this becomes the ways in which you fight your way through the noise of common sense in order to say something that's striking, as a policy guide, we unfortunately have a lot of people who not only don't know history, but in some ways don't think they even need to know or would be hindered by too much knowledge of history.
It's curious. I mean, I love my old T-shirts, for one thing, but for another, the reflex, especially in government, especially in war, to say, wait a second, have we been here before? Has anybody been here before? It seems like fundamental common sense.
Common sense is a very variable thing, Chris. And then what seems commonsensical now in year 2012 is actually really quite different than, say, what was commonsensical in 1952 or 1902. And of course, one could say that within U.S. history, there's a long strain of imagining that the Americans will do it better, that they will avoid the mistakes of others, therefore they don't really need to know too much. But the George Kennans of the world, say in the 1950s, had a voice, had an importance in the general conversation that I don't think anyone has now in the same way.
One last quote in this litany. This is from you in your own summing up about this age of fracture, that what we call society has not quite disappeared, but it's diminished. It's thinner, smaller, more fragmented, more voluntary, fractured, easier to exit, and more guarded from others. You want to improvise on that theme?
One of the images that comes to me when I think about that is the nature of public schooling. In the 1950s, there was an enormous, maybe exaggerated, but enormous sense that schools held the future of the nation. Public schools, general schools, schools that would admit and were just, there were the doors were being pushed in to admit African-American students with in a terms of equality as never before. Women's education, there was a sense that a public education was what had made this country something quite different from other countries in the world, and our future lay there. Fast forward now, and we still have people who care about education, but the rhetoric around education has changed really quite dramatically. It's less about creating a community, it's less about creating a space of democracy where people have to argue and debate, it's less about projects that kids do together. It's much more about the economic worth that individual students will acquire from education as they go on into jobs. And we have now fractured our public school system in ways that's quite striking, as charter schools, private schools, various other competing schools have altered the landscape in ways that I think would be totally unpredicted.
Have they not improved it in many measures and shaken it up? Joel Klein in the Wall Street Journal this morning is bragging about the performance of charter schools. How seriously do you take that?
Charter schools can do lots of things, but they can't do everything. And one of the things they do is leave other students behind. The thing about the public schools is that if kids were being left behind, there was a kind of visibility to it that was tracking in the schools. But it was a piece of public policy, and therefore it could be changed. There was differential treatment in the schools. There was the ways in which kids in rich suburban school districts got educations that were very different from those in poor urban education. But the idea that charter schools are going to be the panacea, I think is very symptomatic of our time. There's a really wonderful book Albert Hirschman wrote some years ago called Exit Voice and Loyalty, and the question he was asking was, what do you do when things aren't going well? Well, one is you stick to the program. Your family's a mess, but you love it, and you stay there. That's loyalty. And the other was that you tried to get a voice in what was going on. You went to the school board meetings. You argued back with your parents. You said, let's all talk this one through. Let us have voice here. Let us try to work it out. And the last is exit. You just split. You got out. And exit can change the structures. If nobody buys a product, the product ceases to be made. If nobody willingly comes to a school, the school will eventually close. But exit's a very, very messy way of making change. But we like exit. It seems natural. It's certainly easier than voice. And charter school is an example of trying to make change by exit.
You make so many marvelous plays with the words that we hear, and I'm thinking that the whole book is a kind of progression from JFK's long twilight struggle, grim and chancy as he made it, to Reagan's Morning in America, you know, a new sunrise every day, to some sort of, I don't want to say darkness at noon, but weirdness at noon in 2012. Talk about some of these words and metaphors that are so revealing, especially in the mouths of our presidents.
Well, one of the things that interested me really early on in this project, the place it began, was looking at the ways in which the words of presidents changed in the 20th century, late 20th century, because as you just mentioned, in the middle years, the years of the high Cold War, years we don't want to go back to, but years that we need to think about seriously, presidential rhetoric had a very, very strong formula. The formula was about a world of danger, a world of challenge, a world of potential peril, a world of great responsibility, and a world in which individual sacrifice is going to be necessary in order to make it through. This was the way presidents talked, the way Kennedy talked, the way Eisenhower talked. And then with Reagan, something else came in. Reagan, who was in some ways thought of as the great Cold Warrior, lost the words for the Cold War, even as he sometimes played the game of Cold Warmanship. So that he, after his first year, never used the word sacrifice. He almost never used the word peril. He asked very little of Americans, except that they believe in the possibilities of mourning in America. It was, in some ways, he was the first of our psychedelic presidents, the one who challenged us to think differently. And if we thought more optimistically, we thought with a sense of cosmic possibilities, they would all happen. They would be here and now. Now, you may say that's disappeared, but in some ways, it's still around contemporary presidential rhetoric. For Romney, lifting the burden of taxation, and it will be here now. We will be a successful economic machine again. Even with President Obama, there's an unwillingness. There was an unwillingness to say at the very beginning of this economic crash, it was going to be tough. It was going to be long. It was going to be slow. And we needed to get ready for that, to be patient with ourselves, to think in terms of a long-term plan. He didn't say it. His advisors didn't say it. And he's reaping some of the consequences in a kind of impatience that's throughout the country now, that what people hoped might happen quickly hasn't happened.
You make the wonderful point in the book that Ronald Reagan redefined the enemy. It was no longer, you know, anti-communist though he was, it was no longer the Soviets. The enemy of American promise was self-doubt. Very part of a kind of self-help and emotional introspection, positive thinking or something. Part of the psychobabble tide of the time too.
Well, one of the key fracture points of the 20th century is the 1970s, the moment in which this shift in political rhetoric begins to happen. It's also, interesting enough, the moment when the economic equality figures begin to turn around. It's the moment of deep economic turmoil in the country.
The misery index and all that.
Exactly. And what's interesting about the misery index is not just that times were hard in the 1970s. They were hard in the 1970s, but they're hard in the early 1980s as well. And they've been hard in other moments. But a sense of inability to understand how and why the world economy was working as it was. High inflation and high unemployment were not supposed to ever happen simultaneously. Every economist knew that. And suddenly they were happening simultaneously. So it was a moment of intellectual turmoil, a moment of political turmoil, and a moment of great self-doubt. It's that Reagan capitalizes on. So when he says that all we need to do is to restore our self-confidence, in part what he was doing was an operation on Jimmy Carter, who had said, we can't have it all. It was a world of limits. We needed to downsize our expectations. You know, in an ideal political world, you have both. You have a sense of realistic limit, which Carter spoke for. You have a sense of optimistic possibilities, which Reagan spoke for. It's hard to hold them together.
I love the way you write about Ronald Reagan, with a kind of profound respect for his craft and his seriousness, despite all the, you know, the B-actor lines. It's not a surprise that he sort of sits in the middle of this story as a kind of pivot, but it is news that he absorbed so much of it intuitively, and he worked so much of it into his presidential language and into his body language, practically. How do we account for this? And how do we hold him accountable? What did he get right? What did he get wrong? I kind of celebrate a little bit the domestication of the presidency. It's not, you know, on the ramparts in agony of choice every moment, tense, driven, you know, being tested. No, relax. We're in America, you know, well, we'll get through this one. We're doing the best we can or something.
Well, you're exactly right about this. There are many, many myths that have been worked up around Ronald Reagan, and I don't want to try to instantiate those. One of the myths was, you know, that since he had done all his own radio programs, that he was own writer in the White House. He was not his own writer in the White House. You can find this very, very clearly in the Reagan papers, which are a wonderful source for any historian to use. You see the drafts come in, you see the arguments that the speechwriters have, and finally you see Reagan with his own hand going in and making the final cut. But the final cut is that of a really skilled public speaker, shifting the words around, make the rhythm work a little bit better, add some music, cut out the phrases that he thought might create some hiccups in his audience. On the conceptual level, he didn't work on his speeches at all after the very first inaugural address. And he left many of his speechwriters, like Peggy Noonan, wondering what in the world she was supposed to say because she had so little contact with him. But that whole operation, speechwriters, Reagan, political consultants, together helped to ease the transition into this new, more relaxed world, the world without the strenuous existential sense of cosmic choice facing you at every single moment. What's important about Reagan was his ability not to shape, but to gather up and to articulate this new way of understanding the nation. The nation as a place that didn't need to really worry about limits. It didn't need to really worry about structures. That needed to feel better about itself. That needed to get on with it. That needed to recognize the heroes in its ranks. And that was all that we needed. And that would do it.
Have a nice day.
Yes, have a nice day. Exactly. God bless America.
On this large theme of disaggregation and atomization of the country on the model of markets, I wondered, reading your book, whether this whole thing belongs in the file under late capitalism. I mean, when you're selling thousands of brands of shampoo and thousands of brands of cereal to millions of customers who are making their own idiosyncratic choices in the grocery store, in the supermarket of life, and choice itself becomes a mark in this world of our humanness, not solidarity or our common interests, but individual choice. Isn't that a story really of capitalism?
Yes, of course it is. And I love this notion of the supermarket of life. We sometimes imagine that we feel most ourselves when we're going down those supermarket aisles, or many people do. And we know that we're the kind of person that reaches for this soup can rather than that soup can, or we don't reach for any soup cans, or we go to the fish freezer. This is us. This wouldn't be possible without the world of capitalism that we live in. And there simply are many, many more goods to buy across a much greater range than there ever was before. You can show your ecological consciousness by what you buy. You can show your political consciousness by what you buy. You can be socially responsible by what you buy, or at least you can imagine that you are.
How green is your toilet paper?
Yeah, exactly. How energy efficient is your car? Or what kind of statement about self are you making? Capitalism is this. But as you just said earlier, and it's been a crucial thread through this conversation, a capitalism is also about enormous structures, finance, law, persons massed in hierarchical agencies, taking directives from the top, being insecure in their jobs, finding themselves in worlds over which they have no choice whatsoever. That too is the world of capitalism, and that's what puts the goods on the supermarket shelf. But we have shifted, as it were, from the late 19th century, when employed persons imagine themselves first as producers and secondly as consumers. We've let that part of life in which we work in our jobs tend to become less real to us than the free time part, but we don't pay as much attention to that as we should.
Come closer to the present, even the presidential election campaign. But first, what did 9/11 do to this notion of a disaggregated country, a thinner society, and what does it mean more than a decade later?
Well, one of the points that I think is really critical to the whole history here is that no set of dominant ideas wipes out the alternatives. It's never as if there was only one way of imagining society. We live in a very, very complicated nation. People are still arguing with each other all the time. When historians imagine a swing, a mood of the country goes from one thing to another, they're always exaggerating. Multiple possibilities are always there at the same time. But some have much more traction, some have much more power than the other. So it's about dominance, not about exclusion. And what's interesting to me in that regard, move from the philosophical to the truly historical for a sec, is that in 9/11, that, as it were, buried desire to be a part of something larger than oneself, that desire to, in fact, pitch in, to do what one hadn't imagined one was called upon to do, to be a kind of a hero who could march up those stairs of the World Trade Towers and imagine losing one's life for something larger than oneself. That came pouring out in the early weeks after 9/11. You could see it in the journalists, you could see it in the interviews with folks. So did, of course, some much uglier sides of this, some anti-Muslim sentiment that was also a sign of that solidarity, but expressed in more xenophonic ways. So I think 9/11 is interesting as helping us understand that there are multiple possible Americas there, always in formation, always contending with each other. With a different president, with a different set of agendas, 9/11 might have led to that kind of cultural shift that we associate with the 1930s, or that we associate with 1919 in a somewhat different way, when Americans would wake up and say, no, we need to do it differently. But the action of the Bush administration and the action of the intellectuals whom they had gathered there to guide them as to how to respond to 9/11 was, in fact, to insist the world hadn't changed dramatically. You could set things right. You could find one responsible dictator. You could somehow take him out. You could do a quick and cheap invasion of a country. Things would be set right soon. And the term sacrifice is, you know, I tracked through the Reagan materials. It has a fleeting moment in the Bush rhetoric, and then it disappears. So 9/11, I think, was a passing moment, but it's a moment of potential turning, which did not turn.
It did not change the atomization trend.
No, it did not. It did not. I mean, certainly a nation that that goes out into the world with soldiers who basically are there for a job, who are recruited out of a really important minority of the population, but a minority of the population, who are adding no tax burdens to the rest of the nation. This is not the way wars used to be.
Come closer to this moment. You've written that the Great Recession since 2007, getting on for 5 years and into this election year, you say it packed an emotional wallop, but only an intellectual whimper. In other words, no new vision. The age still seems thin on ideas. The movement in ideas, you wrote, has been barely discernible.
I think there's no doubt about that. I think that it's not surprising that when crises come along that people look to the past for the best answers that the past can give them. This was certainly true at the beginning of the New Deal when FDR was and his advisors were groping for ways to try to meet that calamity, and most of what they picked up in the early years was stuff out of the past, much of it out of the ways in which the economy had managed in the First World War. And so the New Deal as we know it was a relatively late growth, but it came out of a great deal of fertile and very, very active thought about how economies and societies worked, how a nation that had met with an enormous economic catastrophe, a calamity, how it could be put back together, and how the economic fortunes of the various parts of society could be made into that interdependent relationship that FDR talked about so much. I think that in this case, partly because our social scientists have let us down, partly because the economists have let us down, partly because the folks in charge of political communication have let us down, there have been very, very few big ideas to come out of the catastrophe of 2008. There's been talk about regulation, all of which would be an excellent thing to do, but none of it breaks new intellectual ground. None of it would surprise the New Dealers. In many ways, they would think they were putting pieces that were relatively conventional from the 1910s or 1930s back into practice. We know the signature legislation for the Democrats in Congress was a piece of legislation that progressives had tried to enact ever since the 1910s, and certainly in the 1930s and the 1940s, 1950s. There's a great deal of catch-up being played. And even those moments when President Obama seems to be venturing into new terrain to talk about a mutual complicity in each other's fates. You remember the speech at Osawatomie, Kansas, where he quoted Theodore Roosevelt, that no one makes it totally on their own in their success in America, that there are people who walk around who have more than they've earned, and there are people that who have much less than they have really earned. And we need to make a society that takes account of that fairness and puts some of that fairness back through the collective action of a democratic governance. But Obama feels much more comfortable talking in a fair chance. Everyone should have a chance to be in the middle class. The middle class needs to defend itself. These are not forward-looking terms.
He's a puzzle. His signature speech, the original 04 convention speech in Boston about it's not red states and blue states, it's the United States. I mean, the gestures are surely anti-fracture. Yes, We Can, as you write, has a certain social movement ring about it. But does anybody really believe that that's what he's about or has chosen to be about, even in 2012?
Well, again, he's up against a lot of structural constraints. He's certainly now not able to do anything certainly till the election, and he's not been able to do anything since Congress the House of Representatives moved into the hands of not only the opposite party, but a party really pledged to make sure that nothing changed under the Obama administration. So we have to give him a certain kind of break there. And then the first administration, he was stuck with the dynamics, the structural dynamics of his own party, which didn't come out looking very pretty either. But he's been a very cautious president. His opponent now, Mitt Romney, is a very cautious man as well. And if you ask what new vision they've articulated for America, it's not that they're not capable of doing that. I think of President Obama's speech on race, his Philadelphia speech. It was an extraordinarily interesting and important speech in helping Americans think about race, not as something that happens to certain kinds of people, but as a condition of society in which we all live in, where people are marked and divided and stigmatized, and to be able to talk about the structures out of which that came, talk about this, the experiences in which that leaves Americans, to talk about the ways in which, indeed, this extremely divisive thing, racial animosities, in fact, joins us together. That was a great speech. But he's not been able to do that on the issues that now tear us apart, particularly on the economic scene.
Two questions. Does the fractured country want to come together?
I don't think it will happen from the top. I think that in each one of the cases that we can talk about, even when they're great presidents, as we think about them in the history books, leaders of real capacity, they have been able to lead only because they are, in essence, getting themselves out at front of a social movement, in front of a set of persons of strong desire, in front of action that's already taken place outside of their articulation of some of the key words of our society. So FDR without the labor movement is a figment of our excessive admiration of presidents. Lyndon Johnson without the civil rights movement simply is not the president whom we know. So the question to my mind is not what the leaders are going to say to help change this condition of fracture, but how are actual ongoing things that people do in their daily lives that are different from shopping, different from getting that can of soup or that automobile. How are those cooperative and collective actions, those times when they don't choose for exit, they choose for voice. They talk with their neighbors, they talk with folks, and not just to shout at them, but to try to reason with them. If that's going on in society, and I really do think you can find it everywhere in America and around the world, how does that get a voice in Tony Judd's term? How does it get a language? How does it get the traction that it deserves and that it potentially already has?
And the answer is?
The answer is, if there's a polemical side to the book, I think you've already put it in your own words, taken from what I've done and what many others have done. We have to understand human life as more than choice. We have to understand human life as doing things responsibly in society. And once we stand up and say, that's who I am, I'm a person who lives in a community. I'm a person who doesn't always get his way. I'm a person who has to work it out. But I think I work it out pretty well. I think I'm a pretty good cooperative citizen in the world that I live in. Once you begin to be proud of that, we may have a chance.
Last question. You know, the optimists out there say that the progressive era from the 1880s to the New Deal is the hope and the model of the way we do things, build up a variety of reform movements and get them together somehow and hope for a break and things come together again. I've been wondering, and just in the last few days, could the progressive movement have possibly got traction if it was up against Citizens United and the power of the incumbents of the power to spend without limit to crush them?
Yes. In fact, the progressives were up against a plutocracy, as they called it, that was just as striking, just as self-confident, just as aggressive as the one that we have now. They didn't work in the same media climate. But one of the most important points of progressive era reform was to try to find ways to get wealth out of politics. They did that, for example, by the direct election of senators, because they were convinced, and they had a lot of evidence to prove it, that a very wealthy interest bought up the legislators and therefore bought up the senators, who at that moment were chosen by the state legislators. They enacted our first serious estate taxes, our first progressive income taxes. And against a very, very well-orchestrated, concerned, very exceedingly well-financed opposition. It can happen.
Dan Rogers, thank you. I learned so much from your book. I learned something more from your conversation. Can't thank you enough.
You're very welcome, Chris.
I'm struck here by an alternative villain in Dan Rogers' Age of Fracture. Not the usual suspects in politics at all, no. It's this theory business. 30 years of the small is beautiful, postmodern, university-based theory class that so sliced and diced our identities and seems to have missed the big forest for the little trees and devalued a lot of the deeper human connections among all of us lonely shoppers. And then they wiped out history, which is to say memory. How strange that while we were entertaining ourselves with the end of history theory, we may have stumbled with that blindfold on into the merciless historical fate of empires and never saw the end coming. The theory class has some explaining to do. And I'm heading down the road in New Jersey to sit with another eminent historian of the American condition, Jackson Lears of Rutgers and Raritan magazine. Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation with Daniel Rogers of Princeton. Age of Fracture is his latest book. The conversation isn't over until listeners, that's you, check in with a comment at our website, radioopensource.org. Where are you feeling this fracture? And how are you dealing with it? I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.